It's Tuesday, December, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, how to confront terrorism is discussed at the White House and on the campaign trail. The Islamic State battlefield is deeply entrenched online.
This is the result of a longer trend that's been clearly accelerated by the recent attacks.
Elections in France reflect recent voter sentiment following the Paris attacks. Also ahead, Ron Howard sails to theaters with a new movie. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation says authorities believe both suspects in last week's mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, were radicalized for some time, and that there is evidence that they had pre-planned the deadly attack. David Bowditch, of the FBI's assistant director in charge of the Los Angeles Field, said that the FBI is still investigating how long the couple, U.S.-born Syed Rizwan Farooq and his Pakistani wife, Tashfeen Malik, were planning the attack. But he added there's no evidence at this point that the shooters were part of a broader overseas plot. Farooq and Malik carried out the mass shooting at a gathering of local government workers last May, killing 14 people and wounding 21 others. Their car was later spotted, and they were killed as they exchanged gunfire with police. In a rare televised address from the Oval Office late Sunday, President Obama discussed the attack and sought to reassure Americans on the U.S. strategy to combat terror. The recent attacks in Paris and California have also increased voter scrutiny on the 2016 presidential candidates. Joining us is Newsweek political correspondent Emily Cadet, who is following how the Republicans are reacting to the issue.
What you saw initially, particularly after Paris, was that a lot of the sort of what you'd call establishment candidates, the elected governors and, you know, longtime political leaders in the field, were really trying to make a pitch that they had the experience and sort of the gravitas to handle this sort of serious situation. And it hasn't really worked that well for folks like Jeb Bush and John Kasich, but it does perhaps seem to be starting to work for Chris Christie. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he won an endorsement from a key New Hampshire newspaper, but in that state, he seems to be having a little bit of a renaissance. So it's worth keeping an eye on him. And a lot of it has to do with his sort of tough talk on terrorism and the fact that he was a prosecutor after 9/11 and, you know, has handled terrorist cases and that sort of thing. But the really interesting thing to me is that people like Donald Trump, who really don't have any experience with military or defense or national security, are still hanging in there and doing quite well. I mean, he is still leading in most of the polls. And Ted Cruz, who's been a senator for only a short period of time and doesn't have much foreign policy experience, has actually been surging as well.
Chris Christie has come out against some of those candidates. You quote him in your article as saying, "New seems fabulous until the moment it comes that you need the experience."
Yeah, and I mean, all these guys are using some sort of ominous risk or threat to try and make their pitch. So for Christie, it's sort of him saying, look, when it really comes down to it and something really scary happens, I'm the guy who has the experience and kind of keep us safe. But of course, you have a lot of people that right now are just angry, and what they really want to hear is someone who's promising to take the fight to these jihadists who have been shooting people in Paris and now in California. And so I think that despite the fact that Trump and even Cruz don't have a lot of specifics, they like their tone. It's almost that tone right now matters more than actual substance.
And you make the point, particularly in Iowa, where three-quarters of the Republican voters support sending ground troops, actually, to fight Islamic State. And a large number of them, nearly half, think that Trump is ready to be commander-in-chief.
Right. And again, I think that goes back to sort of how he presents himself. He doesn't show any sort of signs of weakness. He never second-guesses himself. He's just utterly confident all the time. And I think that voters want to feel confident that someone can do something, because a lot of the issues that we're facing in the world right now, particularly in the Middle East, are really difficult and complex issues. And it's nice for someone to have that kind of certainty. I don't know if it's really realistic. I would argue that it's not, because it's a lot more complicated than he's making it out to be.
Some of the knocks against Trump have been that he has not offered any specifics on how to actually go about doing this. He does talk tough in saying we're going to get the guys, but he hasn't really laid out specific plans or ideas of how he wants to accomplish that.
No, and it doesn't seem like the people who support him really mind that. I think they like more the attitude. He has talked about some things. You know, he lambasted the political correctness of people who don't want to profile, you know, Muslims specifically. You know, he's talked about, you know, it's overly politically correct in the country now, and we really need to be looking at some of these questions of how Muslims are getting radicalized, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's one of the things the president talked about last night, was warning against that and really warning against Americans sort of looking suspiciously at all Muslim Americans now, which is sort of what Trump has suggested.
The article that got our attention is How the GOP Field is Being Shaken Up by the Paris Attacks. You can check it out online. Emily Cadet is with Newsweek. Emily, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, it's time now for us to check out what's trending online. And as always, our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is right here in Studio 22. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
What do you have for us today?
We're talking about a quote-unquote tribunal for an agricultural biotech company, and the company is Monsanto, and it's facing a trial by a number of advocacy groups. Monsanto has been in the hot seat for its impact on the environment and people's health for decades, as you know, but the latest announcement is perhaps the biggest blow to the company in recent years.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the company?
Sure. So it currently offers conventional and biotech seeds, also known as GMO seeds, as well as technologies related to yielding crops. The company is on Twitter, at Monsanto CEO, and describes itself as an agricultural company working with others to address the world's food challenges and sustain the environment. But before they got into the food industry, the company primarily dealt with chemicals. They were responsible for manufacturing a number of toxic chemicals, including caffeine 2, Agent Orange, and various pesticides and herbicides.
Well, what is the tribunal? What does this consist of? I mean, doesn't it sound like an official tribunal by an international organization?
Exactly. It isn't. It's a group of professional scientists and environmentalists who have joined forces to stand against the GMO seed giant. And the date is set for October 16th next year in The Hague, Netherlands. Now, the group is determined to charge the American company with what they call an ecocide, meaning killing of the environment. And establishing ecocide as a crime is one of its main goals. Other goals include researching and evaluating the various allegations made against the company in connection to the damages from its products.
And what are they going to base the accusations on?
Well, the tribunal said it will rely on the guiding principles on business and human rights adopted at the UN in 2011. It will also assess potential criminal liability on the basis of the Rome Statute that created the International Criminal Court, the ICC, in The Hague in 2002. You can know more about the group on its website at Monsanto-tribunal.org. Jim?
Well, thanks for that great analysis. G. Abby Lee is with our International Edition team, and we would love to hear from our listeners. You can tweet to us your feedback at VOA_IE, or you can even contact G on her own account at G. Abby Lee, or mine at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the Gate of America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Last Islamic State-led terror attacks in Paris have spurred Western political leaders to try and craft a comprehensive strategy for defeating the militant group on the battlefields of Syria and Iraq, but they are also reminded that many observers that more needs to be done to attack their group, where it has a very sizable foothold, and that's online. VOA's Doug Bernard covers the cyber world and spoke about the issue with International Edition host Susan Yockey.
The U.S. State Department has been trying to counter some of these messages, either the ISIS narrative of pleasant life in ISIS-controlled regions, or those very violent incitements to commit, you know, terrorist acts and that kind of thing. But really, those efforts have just not really to very much. And so there's a sense that more needs to be done, and I think right now people are really struggling to figure out what that more is.
It's said ISIS has used social media very successfully so far.
Yes.
What are they doing right, and what can be done to counter that?
You know, interestingly, two of the things they've done right is they have thousands upon thousands of social media accounts across a variety of platforms. Twitter is one of the most prominent, but just one. What happens there is those thousands of accounts that pop up and submerge and pop up again kind of mutually reinforce a message, so it kind of pushes Twitter or social media in general to make it appear that something is going viral, even when it may not be. But something else that they're doing right, one researcher I spoke with who studies online virality, what makes things sort of explode online, her research suggests that maybe the most important predictor are emotions, and specifically the emotion of anger. If you see something that gets your heart racing and really kind of makes you flush with anger, believe it or not, you're much more likely to share that. And of course, thinking back to a lot of those ISIS social media posts, that is exactly what they're doing.
Well, you mentioned another time you were talking to me about Anonymous going to war with ISIS. What have they done so far, and what are the concerns about their involvement?
So far, Anonymous has had some measure of success. They've taken down maybe 5,000 or so Twitter accounts. They're planning called a International Day of Rage on December 11th, where they're encouraging people to kind of go out and troll ISIS. But really, these kinds of efforts are more nuisance than they are really kind of fundamentally attacking ISIS online. And one researcher I spoke with, he's a former member of Anonymous, but now he's working more closely with the FBI and other U.S. Intelligence agencies. He says, actually, there's a tremendous amount of valuable intelligence that can be gleaned from these ISIS-backed social media accounts. And so if you're just going about willy-nilly shutting them down, you actually might be shutting down important avenues to learn about the enemy.
VOA's Doug Bernard. Well, France's far-right National Front Party made historic gains in the first round of regional French elections Sunday. It captured between 27 and 30% support nationwide, followed by former President Nicolas Sarkozy's center-right Republicans Party and the governing socialists. The election comes as France remains under tight security following last month's terrorist attacks in Paris that left 130 people dead. Atlantic Council French analyst Ben Haddad told VOA's Victor Beatty it's a trend that has been developing in recent years.
If you look at the European elections in 2014, the National Front came out ahead nationally for the first time. This is the second time they do so on a national basis. It's part of a more broader trend in Europe when you see the rise of a populist party all over Europe that are prospering on the anti-immigration and the Eurosceptic message.
What is driving this? Is it the concern about terrorism, or in France, is there a concern about the economy, or both?
It's both. I mean, it's clear that the recent attacks contributed to this result. I mean, there's been a lot of worry in France over security issues, and, you know, it obviously mixed with the debate of immigration, integration, and refugees, and the National Front has been emerging for the last few years, reinforced by the Euro crisis and the debates over immigration in France. But this is of a longer trend, but that's been clearly accelerated by the recent attacks.
Now, there is a second round next Sunday of these regional council elections. Do you anticipate the Republicans, Socialists, and other parties are going to gang up on the National Front?
The Socialists already announced that in two regions, in the north and in the southeast, they would actually withdraw and support the Republicans, which is a center-right party, the one of the president, Nicolas Sarkozy. So maybe that could give a shot to the Republicans. But this is mostly symbolic at this point. I mean, these are not a major turning point in terms of political power in France, but it's an ominous sign just a year and a half before the presidential election of 2017.
Well, the Le Figaro front page Monday is reading the shock, while the Libération headlines is getting closer, a reference to the party's quest for power. What do you make of those headlines?
I mean, it is a shock for the French elite. But at the same time, I mean, it's also a wake-up call that it's time to really confront, on the one hand, issues that the National Front has been talking about, the limits and the failures of European integration and the questions related to integration French national identity, security. These are issues that the French care about and that the elite has been extremely reluctant to address because they didn't want to reinforce the National Front, but at the same time do it in a much more inclusive way, in a much more positive way.
Ben Haddad says while the National Front is a long way from competing at the presidential level with the Socialists and Republicans, its newfound strength will have an impact on how major issues are discussed. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
A new film from Academy Award-winning director Ron Howard, In the Heart of the Sea, stars Chris Hemsworth as the first mate of an ill-fated whaling ship. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the movie looks at the story that inspired Herman Melville's literary classic, Moby Dick.
In the autumn of 1820, the whaler Essex and its crew set off to find and harvest whales. Whale oil powered the Industrial Revolution and lighted the world's cities. The Nantucket-based Essex sailed first to South America, but finding the hunting poor, headed to the middle of the Pacific. By November 20th, the ship's crew had harpooned whales, but one of their boats had been damaged. As first mate Owen Chase, played in the film by Chris Hemsworth, was repairing the damaged boat, a huge male sperm whale rammed and sank the Essex.
Mr. Chase!
God damn it.
Fine, Mr. Lawrence.
What happened next became the stuff of nightmares. Chase, the Essex's Captain George Pollard Jr., and their remaining crew spent 3 months in the middle of the Pacific. Before the survivors were rescued, they would resort to cannibalism to stay alive. To portray their ordeal, Hemsworth, normally known for his massive physique as the Marvel comic hero Thor, had to go on a 500-calorie-a-day diet. A photo of the emaciated Australian actor went viral on Instagram. At the film's premiere, he said that everyone was dedicated to showing the suffering of the men of the Essex.
Yeah, we wanted to sort of show a frame of the film and what we were going through and a portion of sort of what that experience was like. And, it was hard work getting down to that weight for all of us, but we had a pretty tight unit. You know, all the cast were doing it, so it was a lot of support as opposed to doing it on their own.
Tom Holland, who plays young seaman Thomas Nickerson, says that the director, Ron Howard, strove for authenticity in everything, which meant that everyone had to look like they were starving.
This is a true story about real people, and we had a duty as actors to do justice to these characters. And Ron made sure that every aspect of this film was authentic, so that meant we had to starve, learn how to sail, really go out to sea. So it was pretty grueling, but, you know, all for a good reason.
In the Heart of the Sea is being released as Japan is sending whaling ships to the Antarctic, in a controversial culling, which Tokyo says is scientific research. Director Ron Howard says his movie does not aim to glorify killing whales, but to reflect its time.
Obviously, you look at our movie through the prism of history, but I think if you also watch it, you'll see that it's not a pro-whaling movie that's meant to romanticize the process. It acknowledges the brutality, but it also recognizes the truth that was the energy industry of its day, and that's kind of a shocking thing to think about.
In the Heart of the Sea also stars Ben Whishaw as a young Herman Melville, who would later use the Essex's sinking as the inspiration for his novel, Moby Dick. The movie is rated PG for violence and elements. In the Heart of the Sea opens in the United States December 11th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website. That's voanews.com. We hope you stop by there after our program and check out all of the latest news and features. It's available to you any time of the day or night. We're also on Twitter. @VOA_IE is the handle to follow. Our engineer is Zina Bobdell-Rockman. Our director, Tracy Carter. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The foreign minister of the Republic of Angola, Jorge Chicot, made an official visit to the United States on November 18th. The meeting between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Foreign Minister Chicot was the second ministerial-level meeting of the U.S.-Angola Strategic Partnership Dialogue. The two delegations reviewed the advances made in the bilateral relationship over the past year since the previous strategic dialogue in December 2014. The United States congratulated Angola on the progress made over its 40 years of independence. The United States and Angola reaffirmed their pledge to work together on the UN Security Council to address critical global and regional issues. The two countries also committed to working together to find a peaceful resolution to the crisis in Burundi, Democratic Republic of the Congo, and South Sudan. Both the United States and Angola recognize the importance of intensifying and diversifying the bilateral trade and investment cooperation while upholding international commitments and standards. Angola and the United States agreed to build on the progress made during the International Maritime Security Conference by strengthening collaboration in the area of maritime security, particularly in the development and elaboration of a national maritime strategy. Angola reaffirmed its commitment to work with the United States to combat money laundering and terrorism financing. Angola and the United States reaffirmed their commitment to support the further development of democratic institutions and respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, assembly, press, and religion. The United States and Angola expressed their satisfaction with the first bilateral human rights dialogue, which was held in November 2015, as a positive advancement in mutually addressing issues of concern. Angola reaffirmed its interest to join the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative and Voluntary Principles and underlined its ongoing review of the agreements. The United States congratulated Angola on its successful Kimberley Process chairmanship, particularly the accomplishment of expanding the Kimberley Process dialogue to include discussions on the voluntary principles and anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing. The United States is proud to continue working with its partner Angola for the security, prosperity, and happiness of its peoples, the African region, and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.